You're listening to Severance by Andy Evans. Chapter 10, General Revelation. Amos Abercrombie sat at the desk in the sheriff's office, stooped over the computer, beads of sweat clear upon his brow, worry lines apparent on his face. He was trying every trick that he could think of to boost the reception on his computer so that he could note any communication coming towards the moon from however far away. He didn't just want to receive the message, he felt he needed to receive it. If nothing came through, he knew that the guy in the suit would start to question the need to keep him alive. He might think that Amos was deliberately procrastinating. What would he do then? And if Amos couldn't boost the reception, was he really necessary? Just watching a blank screen for no reason? The spinning in his mind was agonizing. If he proved useless, he would die. If the message came through, he'd become surplus to requirement and he may die anyway. Judge and his boys had proved completely unable to prevent this guy from sweeping across the moon, wiping them out if they proved unnecessary to him. Once he disposed of Judge, a number of the Storm Riders jumped ship and offered to assist the man with the blue hands. He'd got them to round up all the townsfolk and to escort them to the hall where they were now being held under threat of death from the Storm Riders. But in reality, he was looking for one man, General Mara. If everyone was in one place, it became easier to recognize the threat. Anyone female or physically inappropriate could be discounted immediately. They were held on one side of the hall, and on the other side of the hall were the males who all possessed a large frame or a military bearing. One by one, these individuals were taken from the hall to a small office, escorted by a Storm Rider. There, in a dimly lit room, they were set with a bright light shone directly into their eyes, masking the man in the suit, so that all they could see was his outline and his blue hands as he slid the same photo across the table to each individual for viewing. The process was always the same. The Storm Rider was dismissed and told to ready the next victim. Having done this, what seemed like a disembodied voice asked each of them in turn to study the photograph. "Do you recognize this? Do you know where this picture was taken?" The answer was inevitably negative. No one was going to admit to knowing anything on this count. "The man is wearing the uniform of an officer of the Alliance. Do you recognize that uniform?" Some said they did from their time in the military, and one or two correctly identified the designated rank of general. They were the ones who seemed to know a little more than they were telling. But as soon as the hum started, as soon as they felt the blood begin to run from their nose, the questioning seemed to change gear. Now the questions were altogether more forceful. Was this the price that they must pay for possessing a little military knowledge? It's long been said a little knowledge is a dangerous thing. The rapidity of the questions fired at them was designed to disorientate the victim. They were simple questions at great speed, barely allowing them to spit out an answer before another question was shot at them. "What's your name? What's your date of birth? Where were you born? What did you do during the war? Where were you stationed? What was your rank? When did you move to Severance? What was your mother's maiden name? How many siblings did you have? What work are you currently doing? Who's your wife? How many children do you have? Did you experience frontline combat duties during the war? Where did you serve? How many men did you kill? How many men did you watch die? What did you think when you watched another man die? Did you receive treatment for any injury? Did you suffer post-traumatic stress disorder? Would you serve again in the Alliance if called? What is your opinion of a brown coat?" It was one question after another, and depending on the answers given, the questions were accompanied by an increase or decrease in the hum. Many of those interrogated were dragged back into the hall, looking close to madness by the end of the experience, and yet it had lasted no more than 10 minutes or so in total. None were willing or able to discuss what just happened to them in that room. Eventually, the fear and anticipation grew to such a point that one or two of those awaiting interrogation soiled themselves before they'd even been called up to the room. And then, without warning, The man in the suit called a halt to proceedings and left the room, leaving those yet to be interviewed dangling in trepidation. He simply walked out of the room, out of the hall, across to the sheriff's office to speak to Abercrombie. The door of the office swung open, and Abercrombie flinched, wondering if this was the moment he would meet his end. "Has there been no signal?" demanded the man in the suit. "I've been trying. I've boosted the signal in the reception to go as far as possible out into space. But so far all I've heard is static and space junk. I haven't received a coherent message of any sort yet." The perspiration ran down his nose, and he winced in fear. But he quickly added, "I've just widened the arc and looped my signal. It's only just happened. I'm hopeful it'll bring me some success shortly." "It is impossible that it would take him this long to reach this moon. Something must be wrong. He left the core planets just after I did. I now have to assume that he is not coming. I need you to do another job for me." Abercrombie sighed a huge sigh of relief. The no-show by this man's partner had extended his own usefulness, and thus his lifespan. "I will need you to make an exit from this rock under my own steam. I need you to search the official records for a ship powerful enough to transport me from here to the next civilized planet that I may command myself. It doesn't need to be a one-man ship, just something that will set me on my way. Alert me if you find such a vessel. If there is no such small ship, expand your search until you find me something that will take me off this dust bowl."
I will. I'll do that. I'll get on it right away. But at the same time, I'll leave the Ark sweeping the airways for any message that may come for you. Stranger things have happened before now."
"What happened to the guard I left outside the door?"
"He isn't there."
"The office was unattended from outside when I arrived. I trust the judge's men will not let me down. If they do, they die. If I leave a man on duty here or at the town's gates, I expect them to do their job. I have more pressing matters to attend to. You should lock this door. I cannot afford any more men to watch over your work. Lock it when I leave." And with that, he turned on his heel and exited the room, leaving Abercrombie wondering how to check for registered ships. Nevertheless, he was prepared to do anything asked of him at this stage. The man in the suit chilled him to the bone and did not make empty threats. This new task was a lifeline he intended to seize with both hands. As the man in the suit emerged from the office, he was confronted by the sight of a buggy tied up across the street. A buggy he had not noticed before. This was a fact he noted immediately, but as no occupants were present, he decided to swiftly dispatch two storm riders from their ever-dwindling number to take their guns and go seek out the driver of this buggy. This could, in actuality, be the very man he was seeking. General Mara. Meanwhile, Daniel and Isabel had left the buggy to search on foot, remaining stealthy so as not to be subject to whatever fate had befallen the storm riders, whose corpses littered the streets. Daniel had sought any makeshift weapon he could find, but was unable to come up with anything more effective than a shovel until he finally found a rider still in possession of a gun and bullets. He stripped the corpse of the weapon, but retained the shovel nonetheless. Isabel walked behind him. They saw the man in the suit. Daniel realized it was the man Jacob had pestered on the flight to Severance. He was walking from the town hall to the sheriff's place, but he hadn't seen them, nor their transport at that point. They hid in an alley at the side of the building nearest them. When the coast was clear, they ran across to the hall and peered through the windows. They could see townsfolk huddled on one side of the hall, but no one saw them outside. They turned and were just about to move from the alley when a storm rider walked across their path with his back to them. Daniel, almost without thinking, landed an almighty blow on the rider's cranium. He fell like a stone.
Daniel dragged him into the alley and they placed his lifeless body into a trash bin. "Why didn't you shoot him?" asked Izzy.
"Because then everyone inside would hear that we were outside," explained Daniel.
And then they saw the man with the blue gloves return from the sheriff's office, making his way back to the hall. He barked some inaudible orders to the storm riders, and they emerged with a sense of purpose, having been dispatched to uncover the rider of this mysterious buggy. There seemed to be around 20 men who left the hall and moved out in a sweeping pattern across the street, each armed and dangerous, but none in the direction of the alley. Isabel peered through the window again. She noticed that there were now only 3 men watching the townsfolk inside. It was merely fear that kept the townsfolk compliant. Suddenly, they heard rapid gunfire a few streets away. Clearly, they weren't the only ones who were not in the town hall. Daniel ordered Izzy to stay where she was, hidden in the alley. He hoped that she would be safe, as so few riders remained. She made herself as small as possible, drawing a couple of trash cans together, including the one with the rider in, to make a makeshift form of cover. She could hear her heart pounding as she waited, not knowing what to expect. There was a scream from the sheriff's office and then silence. The gunshots had also stopped. Nobody emerged from the hall, though. Manpower was clearly stretched to capacity now. It had to be, given the scenes of horror and devastation they witnessed upon their return to town. How many, or how few, storm riders could remain now? Who was the man in the suit? What did he want? Izzy forced herself up to use her vantage point once again. She was about to peer in the hall when another scream pierced the air. She ducked out of sight as a matter of reflex. This time, another 2 storm riders came from inside the hall. She crouched down low. That meant there could only be 1 guard inside now, him and the man in the suit. She could see the feet of the riders. As they came into the alley, her heart started thumping. It was sure to give her away. They must be able to hear it. From her low, low position behind the trash cans, all she could see was feet. Feet drawing ever nearer. And then suddenly, 2 more feet dropped into view. And there was the swishing sound of a blade, and the 2 storm riders fell dead, the other person disappearing back into the air, it seemed. She sat up and looked. There was no one there. No one except the 2 fresh corpses, sliced with a single blow to each. Neither had even had time to scream. Then she heard it, a hum coming from inside the hall, low at first but rising in intensity. A blue glow emerged from the windows. Isabel did take the chance this time. She saw everyone inside trying to cover their ears, everyone including their guard, in agony on their knees. She saw blood beginning to emerge from eyes, noses, and mouths. She picked up a trash can without thinking and heaved it through the window. The crash only opened up the sound to her even more, a sound that cut through to her very core. But she was unable to do nothing. She leapt into the hall, oblivious to the pain the noise was causing, and ran towards the exit, calling everyone to follow her out into the street. Some did. Others were already too far gone. They would be going nowhere. The screams of agony became obvious as they emerged from the blue light into the sunlight, and many fell simply where they stood. But as they emerged, Isabel ran out and saw one man stood before her, the man in the suit. You were not alone. You could not have caused this level of carnage to these mercenaries alone.
Who are you? Cried Isabel.
You don't need to know who I am. You need to tell me who you were working with here. I demand to know.
I can't tell you anything, she began.
Very well.
Then perhaps your softer feminine side will give in when I threaten a child.
With this, he grabbed a small boy and held a gun to his temple. Isabel gasped. She knew who this little boy was. It was Jacob Fitzalan.
Jacob! She exclaimed.
Tell me who you were working with, or I shoot the boy. I will not repeat myself.
The agony and the anguish she felt sliced her in two. If she told the man about Daniel, she could save Jacob. But the man may still kill him anyway. He clearly had no qualms about killing. He just attempted to murder the entire population of the town. But just as she struggled internally, a figure stepped into the street. It was Daniel.
"I am the man you're looking for," Daniel said.
"Daddy!" cried Jacob.
"Let the boy go. I won't pose any threat to you."
Daniel looked disheveled. He'd clearly been fighting.
"I am looking for General Mara. He is the man I am looking for."
"Are you admitting that you are General Mara?"
"I'm not answering any questions until you let the boy go."
With that, the man released Jacob. Isabel grabbed him, prevent him running to his father. Where was Martha, she wondered.
"Very well. I have done as you asked. Are you General Mara?"
"I am not."
"Are you former military?" demanded the man in the suit.
"I am not," replied Daniel.
"You couldn't have caused all this havoc without some form of military training. You've taken out these men with skill and precision. You've killed swiftly and without remorse. You have to be military, perhaps even special forces."
"I think you'll find I've killed no one."
"Then who?" began the man in the suit. He was cut short as a man in special operations uniform called from a rooftop above them. He was clad in black with goggles obscuring his features.
"I am, or was, General Mara. I am the man you are looking for. I took out these men."
Isabel couldn't make out much more than the silhouette. He was carrying a crossbow with some sort of sword strapped across his back. He fired a bolt across the street, using a line attached as a death slide to descend from the upper story. In the confusion, Jacob ran to Daniel, who'd moved towards Izzy. But with lightning speed, he'd also fired another bolt, one which landed in the hand of the man holding the gun. The man in the suit was writhing in pain as Mara descended.
"Martha," Daniel asked, "has anyone seen my wife? Jacob, where's Mommy?"
"I don't know. She didn't come back," said the little boy. "The men took her away. She didn't come back."
The agony of not knowing his wife's fate turned to anger, and Daniel went for the man in the suit. He threw a punch in the man's face.
"What have they done with my wife?" he demanded, his face and his eyes full of rage.
The man in the suit smirked.
"Oh, you'll have to ask the Storm Riders that one." "Oh dear, you can't, can you? They're dead."
Isabel pulled Daniel back. There was nothing to be gained from this violence. If he didn't know, he didn't know. But what no one was seeing at the time was the man in the suit had pulled the bolt clean through his own hand. He stood up and with extraordinary force threw the bolt directly at Mara, landing it in his shoulder. Mara drew his sword and sliced the man across the chest. The man fell before them, nothing more than a shell. Isabel ran to assist Mara. He was, after all, injured.
"It's okay, Izzy. It's just a flesh wound, nothing more."
She recognized the voice. She gasped.
"Grandfather?"
"This is your grandfather," gasped Daniel. "But you died in the house fire."
"That is what I needed people to believe. I couldn't allow them to take Isabel, so I faked my own death."
"Then who was the corpse at the farm?" Daniel asked.
"That was this man's partner. He landed some days ago, and I recognized him, realizing the need to dispose of him post-haste. I knew he'd have a partner elsewhere on the moon."
What did they want, Grandfather? Why did he call you General Mara?"
"It's a very long story, Izzy, but he wanted to get you."
"Me?"
"You were chosen at birth to join a special training program, to become a weapon of the Alliance. Your own father had offered you up to the program while he was at the Academy. I couldn't allow that. I had to stop him and those like him. I planted the bomb that killed your parents. It wasn't meant to kill your mother, but it went wrong."
"I don't understand."
"She was meant to be with me, but she returned home without telling me, leaving you in my care. She died by my hand. I couldn't live with the guilt. I fought my way off the planet with you in my ship. I disappeared. I fell off the radar. Brought you out here. I didn't even have any further contact with the Browncoats. The guilt in killing my beloved daughter meant that I had to give up everything for you."
"And that's why you never wanted to mix with anyone here."
"The more people who knew me, the more risk of being discovered. Now we're going to have to move on. The Alliance still wants you.
That's why they sent these men after me. We have to leave. I have a ship prepped and ready to go if you're ready to come with me.
But we need to help to find Martha.
It's now or never, Izzy. Our presence here can only provide heartache for everyone else. Look at what the Alliance already sent out here. We can't stay, or even more people will die.
Daniel looked at Izzy. It's okay. We'll survive. Severance will survive. I'll find Martha myself. I won't rest.
But your grandfather's right. They will come back for you. Can't stay.
I know.
With that, Cassius put his arm around his granddaughter and the two walked away without looking back. The townsfolk of Severance made no effort to stop them. Nobody spoke. Cassius helped Isabel up into the buggy and the two rode away to find the waiting ship that could speed them to their new lives.
And Severance?
Severance picked itself up. Sure, the Alliance sniffed round a little, but it all blew over like one of the dust storms of the planet itself.
Legend eventually told tales of the old man who fought off an invasion. There was even a statue in his honor placed outside the town hall. But no one ever saw or heard from Cassius Mara or his granddaughter Isabel Chang again.
You have been listening to Severance by Andy Evans, Chapter 10, General Revelations, read by Andy Evans. The music featured in this podcast was provided under a Creative Commons license, courtesy of Magnatunes. You heard tracks by Shira Kamen and Claire Fitch from their albums Mistral and Ambient Cellist. The theme tune to Severance is Le Crabe Noir, performed by Shira Kamen. Further details of this music can be found at magnatunes.com, and we thank them for providing the music throughout this series. As this has been the last chapter of this story, we would like to thank everyone at Badger Books, The Signal, Tales from the Verse, and of course, Joss and the Big Damn Heroes, for the encouragement and support we've received throughout. So to you all, stay shiny, keep flying.